What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States and Russia appear not yet to have reached agreement on how to end the violence in Syria. Their respective diplomats, Secretary of State John Kerry and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, are to meet again perhaps this week in Geneva, but U.S. spokesman Mark Toner said Kerry remains committed to resolving outstanding issues leading to a durable cessation of hostilities, humanitarian access, and a resumption of peace talks.
We hope to get there, but we won't agree to an arrangement, as we've said before, that does not meet our core objectives. But at this point, as I said, nothing to announce or confirm in terms of travel.
University of San Francisco regional analyst Stephen Zunis said one of the sticking points is who actually is a terrorist and who is a rebel opposed to Bashar al-Assad.
The Syria and the Russians, of course, see all the rebels as bad rebels. The United States makes distinctions between hardcore Islamists like al-Nusra and the more moderate elements that the United States has historically supported. Then, of course, they're the really bad rebels, that is, the Islamic State, which both sides see as the priority.
Zunis said there are issues of humanitarian access, Aleppo, and Turkey's recent incursion. He gives the U.S. and Russia a 50-50 chance of reaching agreement. Gabon's newly re-elected President Ali Bongo is dismissing European Union criticism over the disputed August 27 election that he won by a thin margin over his main rival, opposition candidate Jean Ping. In a broadcast interview aired Wednesday, Mr. Bongo insisted he is a Democrat and would be in favor of the country's highest court taking up the allegations of electoral fraud. He insisted it was Ping supporters behind any rigging. Tuesday, an EU Observer mission reported a clear anomaly at a Bongo stronghold with 99% turnout and a 95% vote for Bongo when nationwide only 48% of voters cast ballots. This is VOA News. In Afghanistan, Taliban fighters are threatening the provincial capital of the country's central Uruzgan province. Regional officials say police and soldiers are defending Tarinkot with minimal reinforcements, no significant air support, and insufficient food and ammunition. Taliban fighters briefly occupied the northern city of Kunduz last year and currently threaten the capital of southern Helmand province. The two major U.S. presidential candidates took part late Wednesday in separate broadcast interviews on national security. Republican Donald Trump insisted that as president, he would have a better relationship with Russia's President Vladimir Putin than does President Obama, although he does not like Russia's political system.
But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country. We have a country where you have Hillary Clinton with her emails that nobody's ever seen, where she deletes 33,000 emails, and that's after getting a subpoena from Congress. If you do that in private business, you get thrown in jail.
His Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton, insisted she has the qualities of steadiness and strength to be America's commander-in-chief, as well as the experience having served as a senator and secretary of state. She defended her handling of classified information while America's top diplomat. Zimbabwe's High Court Wednesday struck down a two-week ban issued by police on public protests, the case brought by members of the country's opposition and despite a pledge by President Robert Mugabe to launch a crackdown on anti-government demonstrations over the state of the economy. Mr. Mugabe has been critical of the court system for allowing protests that have turned violent. Meanwhile, the country's Human Rights Commission is accusing the government of denying food aid to opposition supporters. About one-third of the country needs some sort of outside assistance or government aid because of persistent drought. Tech giant Apple Wednesday unveiled its new water- and dust-resistant iPhone 7 in San Francisco. Tim Cook is Apple's CEO.
We are so excited about iPhone 7. It makes all the things you do every day so much better.
The iPhone 7 and 7 Plus come with a faster processor, longer battery life, and better cameras with no headphone jack. The product rollout comes amid slowing global sales of mobile phones as people hold on to their current models. Venezuelans once again took to the streets Wednesday, demanding authorities allow a recall referendum against President Nicolas Maduro to go forward this year. Outrage is mounting over shortages of food and medicine, threatening Mr. Maduro and his socialist government that he inherited from his late predecessor, Hugo Chavez. Veteran professional golfer Tiger Woods, who's been sidelined for over a year with injury, said Wednesday he expects to re-enter competition next month in time for a tournament in California. Woods, who won 14 major tournaments, has been sidelined, recovering from multiple back surgeries. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barté in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. Congress holds hearings on South Sudan as an envoy says Riek Machar should not return to his former position.
It's clear that he and Salva Kiir are unable to work together, and if they have to have their security forces there because they don't trust each other, those security forces have proven that they cannot coexist in the same town, and so you had the fighting of Juba. We don't want to see a return to that.
Ambassador Donna Booth is the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. President Bashir says peace is returning to South Sudan's war-torn Darfur region. A Zimbabwe court judge strikes down a government ban on demonstrations, and Zambian President Edgar Lungu is set to be inaugurated next Tuesday after a court dismissed challenges to his re-election.
The bottom line is that the election of President Edgar Lungu has not been overturned by any competent authority in Zambia.
Frank Bualia is the deputy manager of President Lungu's re-election campaign. Zimbabwe concludes a program of dehorning rhinos intended to save the animals from poachers. And scientists discover the Achilles heel of malaria. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, Donna Booth, says former South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar should not return to his former position as first vice president of the country. Machar fled South Sudan in July following fighting between his forces and those loyal to President Salva Kiir. As Ayem Biol reports, Ambassador Booth made the remarks Wednesday following a hearing by the U.S. House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa on the crisis in South Sudan.
Speaking during a House of Representatives Foreign Affairs Subcommittee hearing, Ambassador Booth said the lack of trust between Machar and South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has created one of the most extreme humanitarian situations in the world.
It's clear that he and Salva Kiir are unable to work together, and if they have to have their security forces there because they don't trust each other, those security forces have proven that they cannot coexist in the same town, and so you had the fighting of Juba. We don't want to see a return to that.
Riyath Mojtong, the SPLM and opposition representative for North America, said he was disappointed by Booth's remarks, stating that Ambassador Booth's comments support the abrogation of the peace agreement.
It seems very complicated now because the government is talking that there is a peace in Juba, and there is no peace in Juba. And actually, to us, there is no transitional government of national unity, because if the peace collapse, if the two partners actually are not working together, there is no government in place.
Moj also said that President Kiir's appointment of Taban Dengai, who replaced Machar in late July, is inconsistent with the peace deal signed over a year ago. The Associated Press reported last month that South Sudanese troops raped foreign women, beat and robbed people, and killed a local journalist in July in Juba's Terrain compound, a venue frequented by foreigners. Representative Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey and chairman of the House Subcommittee on Africa, says one of his constituents was among the foreigners attacked during that incident, which lasted several hours. The victim from New Jersey was expected to testify at Wednesday's hearing, but decided not to because she was still traumatized, according to Smith. Representative Thomas Rooney, a Republican from Florida, said he does not believe that South Sudan's leaders can reverse the course of violence in the country and urged Ambassador Booth to immediately implement an arms embargo.
And what can it hurt if the United States does take the lead to say that enough is enough? We've got diplomatic envoys being shot at. We've got all kinds of crimes that we've talked about against its own citizenry. We've got humanitarian aid and food being seized upon. We've got the opposition has fled. We've got a government that's lost control of its own military.
Asked if observers should expect a change in U.S. policy towards South Sudan in light of recent developments, Smith said the shift is already in the process of happening, adding that there are only a few days left for South Sudan to pivot on the side of protection and advocacy for human rights. Calling Machar the legitimate leader, Moj said the former first vice president, who was still recovering from injuries sustained while fleeing the capital Juba shortly after fighting broke out in July, is still in control of the opposition forces. Festus Mahai, chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body overseeing the peace agreement, told the Associated Press recently that the legitimacy of Taban Dengai is questionable, but diplomats will continue to work with him because they don't have an option. Brian Adeba, the associate director of policy at the Washington-based Enough Project, says more consideration should be placed on the ability of Deng to lead the opposition movement.
I would reiterate that it's very important to look at Taban Deng Gai himself. Does he have the support of the rank and file of the IO? That is really the determining factor here. If he has, I think then it's good to go. If he doesn't, then that's a problem.
Moj says the majority of the opposition does not support Deng and sees his appointment as a violation of the peace agreement.
Because, you know, that there should be replacement, the process are not legitimate because there was no SPLM opposition that said to replace Machar. It was only four people. And SPLM, IO, as all, we all know, we have 270 members of the National Liberation Council and 28 members of the Political Bureau. And no one sat there to change the leadership, to replace the leadership.
Speaking to VOA after the hearing, Ambassador Princeton Lyman, the former U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, said observers should consider a comprehensive approach when considering the role of Machar.
Because you have to remember that Ambassador Booth talked also about a more inclusive government. And the question is, how do you get to a more inclusive government without more of the supporters of Riek Machar, whether he personally or otherwise is involved in the government?
Lyman added that it is not clear if the U.S. will advocate for Machar's return once the deployment of the Rapid Protection Force enters South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says his government is ready to guarantee the security of anyone interested in visiting Darfur to see for themselves the war-torn region is enjoying peace after 13 years of conflict. This after President Omar al-Bashir said Wednesday that Darfur was at peace more than ever before. Fighting earlier this year near Jebel Merah has displaced as many as 127,000 people, according to the U.S.-based Enough Project, which monitors developments in the region. The group accused the Khartoum government of denying access to the region, which it said has made verification of developments there difficult. But Information Minister Bilal says Darfur is enjoying peace, and what needs to be done now is to disarm rebel groups there and develop the region.
In fact, actually, everybody knows in Darfur now, right? Darfur now in peace. No a single rebel or not an inch occupied by rebels. The roads are very peaceful. People are moving between the cities in peace. Everybody is doing his own business. They return to their villages. And so the people are very actually contented and they are delighted that things are going back to normal. And the last actually battle or the last actually attack, which was in Jabal Marrah when the rebels tried to attack our army, and then this have been changed, and the places which have been occupied by the rebels have been removed. All these people now, they came back to their villages. And the president said today, Darfur is in peace. What we are going today is a development. Now the development is started. Ready, and we are going to continue on that.
So, Minister, will your government let people go to Darfur just to verify what President Bashir is saying?
Absolutely, actually. Everybody comes here and wants to go to Darfur, anywhere in Darfur. We are ready to facilitate for him to go there, and we are sure that his movement is secure and in peace.
When you talk about peace, does this include the Darfur rebels? Do you believe they are also in agreement to what your government is saying?
In fact, actually, most of these rebels, most of this movement, a lot of people have actually came to Khartoum and they signed peace and they joined the national dialogue, most of them. Now what remains now is Minnawi movement, and these are now in Libya. They are fighting in Libya. And Jibril and a few of them are there in the south. And we have a promise from the various vice president in the south that they are going to expel them in about 3 weeks. So nothing now, I tell you, not a single inch occupied by the rebels in Darfur.
Minister, you know that the United Nations Security Council extended the mandate of the UN peacekeepers in Darfur. Do you still think that there's a need for the UN peacekeepers there?
From our side, we are keeping this and telling this. There is no need anyway. And the money which has been now spent for them, it is better to be spent for development in the Darfur. But they want to keep them there. It's okay. For us now, we want them to be convinced that there is no war, there is no actually any sort of violence. Yes, we still have, you know, the tribal problems and this here and there. And this is not only in Darfur, in some area in Sudan. The next step is that the arms should be taken from all people, and this is, will be the next step which the government can do in the remaining of this year. And this is, will consolidate peace, and everybody will be doing his own business without any sort of fear.
Akme Bilal, Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 8th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Zambia is preparing for the official installation of President Ahmed Lungu next Tuesday after two separate courts threw out petitions from the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, challenging the outcome of the August 11 election. Frank Bualia, deputy manager of Lungu's re-election campaign, tells reporter Peter Clarty that there seems to be no more legal tactic the UPND and its leader, Hakainde Hichilema, can use to upend the president-elect's installation for his first full five-year term.
The state is preparing the inauguration of President Edgar Chagwa Lungu, and his running mate will be sworn in as vice president. The only preparation we are doing on our part as a party is because President Edgar Chagwa Lungu, coincidentally, is leader of PF. So it will be our party to form government.
Some people are saying that the UPND, the main opposition party, and its leader, Hakainde Hichilema, has some other legal avenues to seek redress, challenging the re-election of President Lungu ahead of the inauguration on Tuesday, despite the Constitutional Court and another court throwing out some petition. What do you say to that?
The Constitutional Court in Zambia is the competent authority to deal with an election petition. However, there are many courts in the country that somebody who is blinded by the pain of losing an election can still go to. So they can go to the High Court, they can go to the Magistrate Court. The last thing we think they would go to is what is called the baby court. But as far as we are concerned, there is no other competent court in Zambia that can hold inauguration of a president-elect who has been so declared by a competent authority and whose election has not been nullified by the competent authority.
Well, but Father Bualia, the opposition is saying that President Lungu packed the Constitutional Court with his allies, and that is why they ruled in his favor. And apart from that, the Constitutional Court judges contradicted themselves, and that is why there's a petition in court to have some of these judges removed from there. What do you say to that?
It's neither here nor there. The bottom line is that the election of President Edgar Chagwa Lungu has not been overturned by any competent authority in Zambia. And the authority that did not overturn his election is the only competent authority, and its decisions are final. They cannot be challenged anywhere else.
What do you say to Hakainde Hichilema and the UPND and other opposition parties who are saying that President Lungu is not a unifier and that the country is divided, there's tension, and he has yet to unify the country? They said that necessitated a call by some groups in the country, including the church, for President Lungu to unite the country following the elections.
Those who are calling upon the president to unite the country are doing it in a manner that we can say pushing an open door. Because President Lungu, by character, is a man that is unifying. As a matter of fact, those in Zambia who are saying he should unite the country, he should extend an olive branch to the opposition and so on, they are sounding very, very awkward for a simple reason, that no one can imagine President Lungu doing otherwise.
Frank Bualia is the deputy manager of President Lungu's re-election campaign. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Zambia's capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwe's High Court has struck down the government's two-week ban on demonstrations, which was imposed as anti-government protests were gaining momentum. Sebastian Mofu has more.
The ban was announced last Thursday, a day before opposition parties were to hold an anti-government demonstration in the capital. But High Court Justice Priscilla Chigumba ruled Wednesday that the government's ban was, quote, invalid, unquote, because it was done unprocedurally. She issued the ruling despite the remarks from President Robert Mugabe lambasting judges who have been allowing Zimbabweans to protest against the 92-year-old president's leadership. Politician Tendai Biti, a member of Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights who represented the opposition in court, said Mugabe's statements were not appropriate.
He has no right to make those statements, president's statement. They are unconstitutional. The first function of the president is actually to uphold the constitution and the Bill of Rights. That's his first function. So if the president fails in that function, he must resign or be impeached.
Rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have added their concern to the statement by Mugabe attacking the granting of protests by Zimbabwean judges. Here is Human Rights Watch's Dewa Mavinga, a senior researcher for Southern Africa.
President Mugabe's statements undermine Zimbabwe's international human rights law obligations to respect due process and judicial independence, which are guaranteed under the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, a charter, as well as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Zimbabweans have a right to peaceful protest and to express their views freely, and judges should not be constrained in enforcing those rights.
It was not immediately known if the opposition will resume protests, which Mugabe says are alien and lead to violence in Zimbabwe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Zimbabwe has just ended its program of dehorning rhinos in three of the country's national parks intended to save the animal from poachers. According to the World Wildlife Fund, poachers killed 50 rhinos in 2015. Lisa Marabini is a veterinarian and director of operation for Aware Trust Zimbabwe. She tells reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service that dehorning has helped save the rhino from poachers by simply taking away the monetary incentive to kill the animal.
We basically tranquilize the rhinos, and once they are down, we cut off the horn with a chainsaw. And that is as a disincentive to poachers. We feel that it reduces the reward-to-risk ratio. In other words, if a poacher is going to come into a Zimbabwean park, he's going to get a very little reward for the huge amount of risk he is taking. Because under Zimbabwean law, rangers are also authorized to shoot to kill armed poachers in these rhino protection areas.
How many rhinos are we talking about here?
There's roughly 100 rhinos on parks land. I'm not going to go into the population figures for each area because that's sensitive information.
So the dehorning exercise that is currently underway will not affect rhinos on private land?
Well, as I said, you would have to get comment from Low Fault Rhino Trust. I know they will be dehorning some rhinos, but I don't know how many.
But are there no dangers also that still some poachers will continue to illegally hunt the rhinos even though they don't have horns?
You see, when we dehorn, there is a small amount of horn that is left on the rhino because that tiny bit of horn contains some blood vessels, so we cannot remove that. But it's a few hundred grams compared with when the rhinos have a 7 kg horn on their, a fully grown 7 kg horn on their face. So you may find that if a poacher doesn't realize that the rhinos have been dehorned in the area, he may still try and track a rhino and he may shoot it just for that little bit of, the 100 grams or whatever's left on the rhino. But what we like to do is to dehorn everything and publicize the fact that all these rhinos have been dehorned. And we feel that that is quite a strong disincentive for poachers.
When did this program start and when is it ending?
It's actually already concluded. It's finished for the year. You know, it's not actually a new strategy. It's something, as I said, that's been in use since the 1990s. And we've been doing it since 2010 in the three parks that we assist. In two of those areas, we have not lost a single white rhino to poachers in the last 6 years. And in the black rhino area that we assist, the poaching has been reduced dramatically. And we feel that the dehorning has got a lot to do with that.
Lisa Marabini is a veterinarian, the director of operations for Aware Trust Zimbabwe. She spoke from Harare with VOA Zimbabwe reporter Blessing Zulu. Scientists appear to have discovered malaria's Achilles heel, a weakness common to the multiple stages of malaria infection. In doing so, they have found a compound that killed mice of the disease. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Malaria, caused by a parasite that's transmitted through a mosquito bite, infects more than 200 million people each year. Once it's infected a human host, the malaria parasite called Plasmodium falciparum evolves through a number of unique stages, from initial blood infection to liver infiltration, where the parasite matures and re-enters the bloodstream. The parasite then goes on to infect and destroy red blood cells, releasing thousands of daughter parasites that invade other blood cells, continuing the cycle of reproduction and infection. It's during this latter blood stage when symptoms of malaria occur, including very high fever, overwhelming sweating, nausea, and diarrhea. Over 500,000 people do not survive, mostly children in sub-Saharan Africa. At each stage, P. falciparum behaves as a unique organism. Experts say most treatments are aimed at only one stage or another. Over time, the parasite can become resistant to therapy. But researchers at the Broad Institute in Massachusetts and Harvard University have identified a single target that appears to be the disease's Achilles heel, according to senior researcher Stuart Schreiber, a founding member of the biomedical institution.
And we did discover a novel protein that's made by the parasite that's needed for all three phases of its life cycle, and a series of novel compounds that potently inhibit this protein. And we could show in an infected animal that we could kill the parasite in all three phases.
Schreiber and colleagues published their findings in the journal Nature. After discovering the protein, researchers screened a unique library of 100,000 small molecules, from which they synthesized about a dozen compounds that all appear to stop the protein synthesis in all of its life stages, which kills the parasite, at least in a mouse model. The mice were disease-free for a month, a length of time considered to be a cure. When they tried to infect other mice with the blood of the treated rodents, the animals did not become infected with malaria. Schreiber is quick to caution that what works in a mouse is not necessarily effective in humans, but he's hopeful. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Gabonese President Ali Bongo, who has been accused by opposition politicians of voter fraud, resisted calls on Wednesday for a recount of votes cast in the country's presidential election, saying he has no power to order one. And that's it for this Thursday, September 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC GMT right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.